G'day everybody, my name is Glenn Hill.
And I'm Jacob Meyer.
Welcome to the Technical Tennis Podcast, and it's a really international edition today. I'm recording from a bungalow in Costa Rica in between surfing sessions.
And I'm recording from somewhere in Greater London, a couple miles from Roehampton, the site of Wimbledon qualification tournament.
Just a heads up to everybody, Jake's recently become a first-time father, so if he happens to start speaking incoherently or falls asleep in the middle of the podcast, it's probably because he's a little sleep deprived.
I'm gonna make lots of predictions, I think, for the next couple of weeks, and then all of them that are wrong I'm gonna completely blame on sleep deprivation.
Well, we're not really gonna be doing a lot of predicting in today's episode, because we're going to talk about excitement levels and how they impact the way that you play tennis. And probably if we're going to do that, we should start out by talking a little bit about what excitement levels are.
Are we referring to like when my newborn baby just starts screaming, like for no particular reason?
Well, that would be, yeah, that would be a level of excitement.
That's one kind of excitement level. Okay. So
that is. So if we think about, you know, people in their average state, people generally, normal people don't walk around in a state of excitement, right? I mean, we're hopefully pretty calm. And if you think about, like, on a scale of 1 to 10, like a 0 would be you asleep. I mean, you're in a very low excitement state when you're asleep, or maybe in, like, deep meditation.
Right.
And a 10 would be, like, I am literally scared for my life, you know, either petrified or in a complete and utter mind-bending rage. I mean, like an emotional or excitement state that's at the absolute extreme.
You're talking about like jumping out of your skin, full sweat, like full flight or flight response. Like your body is as activated as it possibly could be. Would be a 10.
Yes, exactly. And obviously I hope for your sake, people, that you very rarely hit a 10. Because that's just not a great place to be, generally speaking.
Yeah.
But what we do is exist at various emotional states or excitement states throughout the day and in different circumstances. And most of the time when we have a change in our excitement state, it's because of a reaction to an external stimulus in some form. And what happens when we play tennis matches is that we will typically go through a range of excitement states during our tennis match. And this is one area where I think that most players don't really do a good job of managing their excitement state. And I think more importantly, understanding at what excitement state they have their peak performance and how they can go about creating that desired excitement state for them to play their best tennis in a way that they have control over the process.
Yeah, so I want to start this conversation off for me by personally raising my hand and saying that despite studying this stuff, even formally in graduate school, this is one of the things that I think I was most terrible at when I was competing. Like,
yeah, it's hard. I mean, it's really hard, especially because nobody talks about it. It's really, I think, an unaddressed area. And I think maybe just to put a little context on this really quickly, so maybe if people haven't made that connection yet. I mean, imagine if you go out and try to play tennis in a state of complete and total rage, right, where you're just so angry you can't even form cohesive thought, and you're probably not going to play very well. Or the flip side of that is if you go out and play in a state of complete and total detachment and lassitude, like where you're just half asleep on the court, you're probably also not going to play very well there. And so when we talk about excitement levels and how they impact tennis matches, obviously, well, everybody's going to be a little bit different in terms of where they're going to play their best. But it's probably not going to be at either end of the extreme, but somewhere likely in like the 3 to 7 or 8 range.
Yeah, and this
on that scale of 1 to 10.
This is something that I think most of us realize that. We realize, oh, okay, well, I can't be at a 10. I can't be at a 0. You know, if I'm at a 0, I can't run fast. And if I'm at a 10, I can't make any decisions.
So, well, and I think also most people aren't capable of getting themselves to a 0 or a 10 and walking on a tennis court and playing a match. I mean, so there's that.
Yeah. So, I mean, most of us know that, right? Like, the mistake that I made, I think, is a very common one where I didn't have a traveling coach with me. And so I knew, like, well, I can't be at a 10. I can't be at a 9. Let's say I wanted to be at, like, a 6 or a 7, just for the sake of argument. The problem wasn't in my assessment, but it was in that I didn't have the self-awareness to actually successfully and accurately get me to where I wanted to be. So I went out there and tried to do things that I thought were going to be effective in calming me down and bringing me to the right level. And it turns out that I went way, way, way too far. And people watching me thought that there was something completely different going on.
Sure. And so I think when we look at why it's important to manage your excitement level and why everybody's excitement level is different, it's because your excitement level, I mean, look, the human body is a very complex thing, but in a very real way, everything that happens in our bodies is connected to other things. And so our excitement level, just like if something happened emotionally, like someone that you love came up and told you that you hate them or they hate you, that's going to probably cause some pretty strong emotions. And along with that, you might have an elevated heart rate and, you know, an adrenaline dump. I mean, you're going to have an actual physiological response to that. And so things that happen to us emotionally can affect our physiological state, and things that happen to our physiology can affect our emotional state and our psychological state. So all these things are tied together. And so what is important here is that when we have a certain excitement state, which in this case, I don't even know where I'm going with that. I'm going to edit that out later. When we have a certain excitement state, that excitement state is going to change other aspects of our body and our brain and our mind in different ways, depending on whether our excitement state is elevated or lowered. And if, for example, when I played tennis in college, I was very deliberate about creating a certain psychological state and an excitement state. But then I took time off from competing when I went to grad school. And then after grad school, when I finally decided to go out and start playing futures, one of the interesting things to me was, in singles, the excitement state that I needed in order to play well had changed from where it was in college. And it took me a while to figure that out. And what ended up happening was I was going out and I was playing matches in an excitement level that really did not let me perform well, because for whatever reason, post-college, that gap in competition, when I went out and started playing again, I got a lot more nervous. And for me and my psychology, I needed to be at a really high excitement level in order to that drove me past my state of nerves.
Right.
Having kind of the elevated heart rate and kind of the breathing more heavily, getting blood out to my extremities, really getting like pumped up and super fired up, put me past that state of nervousness and let me kind of move past that and play well. But I spent a lot of time trying to compete at a maybe like a 5 or a 4 even, and I really needed to be at like a 7 or a 7.5 in order to play well. And so I wasted a lot of opportunities playing in a bad state.
In a state that was inappropriate.
This is why. Yeah. Yes, a state that was bad for me to play good competitive tennis at that time. And so part of what I'm getting at here is too that your excitement level, or your peak excitement level, the level that lets you play your best tennis, is going to change in life depending on what's going on in your life and what's going on with you in any given moment. So some people, when they do start to get nervous, will benefit from lowering their excitement level, and some people will benefit from raising it. And one of the things that I did eventually figure out is that when I was in that middle range, kind of like a 5-ish, then the nerves did impact the way that I played in a negative way. But if I raise my excitement level enough, then I overrode it. Or if I calm my excitement level low enough, then that also worked. I just had this band in kind of like this 4 to 6 range that really was really not good for me. in order to play well. Right. And you're going to be different, whoever's listening.
Yeah, I mean,
everybody listening, you're going to be different.
This is the thing about this is, that, like you said before, it's not that it's necessarily a bad state to be in, but it's not the fitting and appropriate state for you to have your optimal performance. And that's where it can be tough, because if someone else was watching you, they might think, oh, this guy's doing fine, and you might be battling nerves inside, making a bad decision, or not maybe hitting as big as you can, or whatever it might be, where the only way that someone's going to be able to see that is if they know your game, right? If they know all your capabilities. That's the only way they're going to be able to judge if you're actually playing your optimal game.
Yeah, absolutely. Because, I mean, it might just be that I was playing at 75% of what I could normally do. But at that level, 75% is the difference between getting blown out in straight sets easily and winning a match in two tough sets. You know, I mean, that's a huge, a 25% drop in performance is massive, but you might only notice it if you know what somebody's kind of normal performance level is.
Even the difference between being at 75% and being at 85% is the difference in you winning and losing that match at that level. And so, I mean, this is just going to be something that's really personal. Like, the way that it looks for you, we know, is different than the way that it looked for me. And we also know that, like, I'm able to play now at completely different levels than what I was able to play then in terms of excitation levels.
Sure. Right. Yeah, I'm right with you on that front. And so maybe just to put a couple of real-world examples for people, if anybody remembers Jimmy Connors' run in the U.S. Open back in, was it 92, when he was in his late 30s and made the semifinals? You know, Jimmy Connors was a player who played his best tennis at an extremely, like, a level of excitation that would probably be uncomfortable for most people.
Oh, yeah.
You know, he's, like, picking fights with people, making snide comments under his breath on changeovers. I mean, he was, like, over the top, and that was where he competed his best. Whereas, you know, if we look at somebody else, like Federer is an example of me to somebody who I think plays well at a pretty low excitation level. When you see him out there angry and getting, like, muttering under his breath, and I mean, that's sometimes connected with the way he's playing, but often sometimes I've noticed that when he goes out in court and he seems irritable from the beginning, that those are the days that he tends to play worse.
Yeah, those are trouble days for him. And he's a guy who, throughout his young career, when he took a lot of losses, he was often way too excited, and it caused him to make a lot of errors. When he plays more calm, all of a sudden he turns into, you know, the Fed, this machine that doesn't make bad decisions and barely ever misses a ball.
Right. And I think maybe an example that will really resonate with people is Rafael Nadal, who actually plays at a pretty high excitation level, but a lot of it's internalized.
We've got to talk about Rafa.
Yeah, because he's not out there, like, Connors is almost literally, like, he's insulting his opponent on changeovers.
he's in your face.
He's completely in your face. Jimmy Connors is somebody who was getting a lot of his excitation level or his excitement level from external sources, like external stimulus. So he was using the crowd to fire himself up. He was being antagonistic with his opponent to fire himself up. Rafa's playing at a very high excitement level, but it's very internalized. So the reason that you can tell that he is, and this is noticeable, where you watch when he's out there and he's about to do the coin toss, the guy looks like a boxer, you know, at a weigh-in. Like, he's jumping around, he's, you know, dancing from foot to foot. He's keeping his energy level high. And then, you know, when the time comes for him to take the court, he doesn't walk out there calmly. The guy literally sprints to the baseline, right?
He's sprinting before he ever hits a ball in the warm-up, and he's basically the only guy that we see on TV. I mean, I shouldn't say he's the only guy, but he takes that to a higher level than anyone else does that we see on television. Okay?
Yes.
And so there's this interesting question of, like, what exactly does that do for him? Like, what is he doing? Why? I mean, Rafa is working up a lather of sweat before the warm-up. Like, he goes out to play Novak Djokovic. He knows, like, I might play five sets. This might be 5 hours. The guy is sweating through a shirt.
Yeah. he's setting that tone from, like, again, before he's even hit a tennis ball, the way that he sprints back there.
This is a little counterintuitive to a lot of us, because I think, like, hey, I'm playing Novak, or I'm playing Fed, or I'm playing Dominic Thiem or Zverev. Like, I want to save my energy, man. Like, what happens if this is a long match? Like, what if I get tired, right? Like,
well, the bigger issue for Rafa is if he comes out and he plays the match poorly, it's not going to be a long match at all, because he's going to lose.
Okay, so
and that's the thing that he understands.
So he's really prioritizing, I'm going to go play my best tennis over anything else.
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, always. I think that's one of the things that Rafa does such a brilliant job of. And if you watch him in matches, like, he does a really... People would make jokes about his water bottles and how kind of obsessive compulsive he seems to be at times. But all of that is a part of the way that he goes about controlling the environment that he plays tennis in and controlling his state that he's playing tennis in. And that's important, because it's part of the reason why he's able to be so consistent. It's not just that he's a great tennis player in terms of his ability to hit a tennis ball. One of the things that makes Rafael Nadal exceptional, why he's won 17 Grand Slams, is his willingness to take care of those little details that allow him to play his best tennis all the time. And I don't want to get sidetracked into kind of his rituals about his water bottles and that other stuff, but his management of his excitement level is a part of that. He's always in a great space to play tennis. Like, he always goes out there and puts himself in the right place to play his best tennis.
I'm going to go out on a limb and say that the water bottle stuff is much less important than what we're talking about today, which is,
oh, absolutely,
this management of his excitation level. Like, this is actually one of the fundamental things that Rafa does better than other people that brings him so much consistency.
Like, yes, but I will go ahead, sorry.
I was just going to say, when is the last time that we saw Rafa lose a first round in a tournament and we just thought, wow, like, he just came out there and wasn't quite ready and lost the first set and got unlucky and lost a match?
Right. It just doesn't happen. But I was just going to add the thought that, I mean, I think in a way the water bottle stuff is important, because I think that's also a part of his management as far as his energy levels goes. You know, I think that's part of also the way that he puts the brakes on himself a little bit. Because, look, I mean, it's great to get ramped up to your right level, but you don't want to ramp up too far. Like, you have to find that right spot and try to stay there as long as you possibly can. And I think there's a way in which, you know, some of the little OCD behaviors are also kind of an emotional or an excitement level breaking system for him as much as anything. But I don't want to get too caught up in the pro player examples, because we want to put this in terms that, and give you tools, listeners, that help you manage your excitement level for your best tennis. Because at the end of the day, I mean, look, I'm sure you'd love to hear us talk about Rafael Nadal for 12 hours, but you're listening to the podcast probably in part because you want to get better at tennis. We've got some helpful, hopefully helpful information about that. And so when we think about excitement levels, you know, part of this is physiological, you know, your heart rate, your blood flow, your breathing. These things play into it. There's a psychological component as well. I mean, it's all tied together, right? And so what are some of the things that we can do to raise our excitement level before we step onto the court to play?
I like Rafa's example here. What Rafa does is he is as physically active as he's going to be in the match, right? So put Rafa's stuff aside. I think you take, okay, well, what's like the most challenging physical stuff that I'm going to do in my match, whether that's going to be sprinting or jumping or lunging aggressively, or maybe it's just going to be jogging side to side. Maybe it's going to be changing direction and moving backwards a few times. And I like to do that physical activity for a few minutes before I step out there and hit balls.
Yeah, I'm going to cut you off here for a second, because I think that that might be an easy thing for somebody to misinterpret. I think that there's two separate issues here, people. One is, look, do a proper physical warm-up before you compete. Right? Do a proper physical warm up that prepares your body just in terms of mobility, and, you know, blood flow to the muscles to actually go out and compete without getting injured. Once you've done that, you can engage in physical activity that's separate from your warm up that helps to set your excitement level. And I think that's partly what Jacob's getting at now is, like, Rafa knows he's gonna play
separate.
Yeah. Rafa knows he's gonna play at an extremely high intensity level That's why he goes out and sprints out to the court for his warm-up, is because he's trying to get that intensity level before he's hit a ball, so that he's there and he's stable in that state, right?
Here's another way to think about it. After you do your warm-up, okay? I mean, you should be clear. Like, you need to do your warm-up. You need to do a proper warm-up. We could have a lot to say on that. That's probably a great topic for another podcast, by the way. But after you do your warm-up, you should have some time before you go out there to hit balls. And the way that I actually talk to players about it is I ask them, where do you want your excitement level to be, let's say, in the middle of the second set? And that's where you want to start the match.
Right.
That's how I think about it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Like, where do you want it to be later on in the match? And then ask yourself the real question, well, where do I want to start the match? Do I want to start the match at a different level for some reason?
Well, for some people, this is important because, you know, for some people, they start the match and they're very nervous at the beginning of the match, and then the nerves go away once they get into the heat of competition. Some people need to start at a different excitement level than they actually would spend most of the match at. This is an important thing because, again, you know, your individual experience is going to be different from most other people's. Not you, Jacob, but as in you, the listener. Some people need to start I think the key thing here is, look, you do your warm-up, and then you have an opportunity to use physical activity to help get you the correct emotional or excitement level. Because when we look at excitement levels, like, the physiological side is part of it. If I go out and I sprint around, I'm raising my excitement level. There's just no way around that. But there are other tools that I can use as well, and the physical activity is part of that. You can, if you need to be at a low excitement level, you can do your warm up and then do some low level physical activity so that you're hitting the court at that right sweet point. If it needs to be higher, then it needs to be higher. But so using physical activity to help set the excitement level is one thing you can do. Then there are other things that we can do as well. Like, I used to use music a lot. I would have a very, very, very short selection of musical things that I would listen to ahead of time that hit a sweet spot for me, for whatever reason it was. Just had me at the right level of getting pumped up. You know, if I needed to be super pumped up, I might listen to something like really high energy. You know, if I was in a point where for whatever reason, I needed to be much, much calmer, I would listen to something really mellow and maybe not even have, it might not even have words. It might just be like some really kind of slower paced, like acoustic music, whatever it is. Like, I would listen to music to help set that tone, because most people are responsive to music in one fashion or another.
I like the use of music as well. I mean, the way that I use it personally and the way I use it with some of the players is we use it as a cue. So we actually use the same music again and again, and we use them for different situations.
Yeah,
so
absolutely.
We might listen to music during a workout that we really like, or we might listen to some songs that are going to be like pre-match songs during practices when we're doing, say, if I have a player that we want to play aggressively, and when we do aggressive drills, we play that music in the background, and then we use that music also for the pre-match.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's a great, great, great way of using music, and that brings me to another way of using music, which is linked in very, very strongly, which is music can evoke responses to for us in multiple ways, and one of them is memory. You know, we can associate certain sounds or music with certain things. And so one of the other things that I would do sometimes is I would listen to specific parts of a movie soundtrack, not because of the music itself, but because of the scene that went along with the music and the way that scene made me feel.
Right.
You know, so let's say that you want to be super pumped up. Well, maybe you want to listen to like some Rocky soundtrack. From the middle of one of the fight scenes, you know,
be inspired.
And yeah, and you listen to that music and it brings back that whole fight thing for you. And then that might get you pumped up. I mean, whatever, you got to fiddle around and figure out what it is that you want out of your cues.
Oh, I just wanted to go to the other end of the spectrum before you move on to the next thing. Like, you know, one of the workouts that I use personally on a regular basis, I listen to a quiet meditation music at the end of every one of those workouts.
Right.
And actually take 5 minutes to just try and bring down the whole excitation level in a conscious way, and it becomes a regular practice. So if that music plays, like if you just played it right now, my immediate response would basically be to start chilling out.
Well, I'm going to need you to play that because you're getting kind of out of control over there. You're just way, right, move on you're to way next, too high energy.
Move on
for
to the next
podcast.
Thing. Come on, keep going. Keep it moving here.
So, you know, so we've got, we can use physical activity to help set that tone. We can use music either just because of, you know, the song's high energy and it gets us all pumped up and going, or because of links it has to other activities, whether you've used that music in training or that music belongs to another stimulus like a movie. That's another tool that you can use. You know, you can think about situations in your life. Like, some people like to picture themselves the last time they won, you know, a big match, or they might have a specific occasion that makes them feel a certain way. You can use memory, like your own personal memory, to help set your excitation or excitement level. I keep using excitation because, you know, from physics and electrons and atoms, and I have a science background, but excitement level is really the one that we're shooting for here. So there's another tool that you can use. You know, there's a lot of different stuff that can affect how excited we are at any given moment. And, you know, you might have stimulus that we haven't mentioned here that works really well for you. And it might be a scent, it might be whatever it is, it doesn't matter. You know, understand that this is a tool that you can use to help try and kind of get yourself in the right state to play your best tennis. Now, what is your best tennis playing excitement level? I don't know the answer to that question, and Jacob doesn't know the answer to that question. Or do you, Jacob? I hope you don't. That would be creepy.
Hey, what are you talking about? We know the answers to every question. No, of course. How could we know without looking at your game very closely?
Absolutely. But
that takes time to figure out.
That's exactly the key thing, is it takes time to figure out. Just like in previous podcasts about strategy, we've strongly recommended that you record yourself playing matches and sit there and watch yourself playing matches on your television and take stats on the things that you do well and the things that you do poorly and figure out what's actually going on with your game, you really have an opportunity to keep kind of an excitement diary. Wow, isn't that an awesome sounding thing about your tennis
matches.
Please
tell me that we're going to publish your excitement diary on the website.
Oh yeah, absolutely. You know it. no, but this can just be something that you keep on your phone, just like a little note, and, you know, put the date, put the match, and then put what your excitement level goal is, and then go out and play your match, and then come off and be like, did I meet that, yes or no, and did I play well, yes or no? And record that, and then do that for the next one. So maybe it's like, I want to go out and play at a 6 this match, and you come back and you be like, look, I actually was at a 4, and I played awesome. And then you know, well, hey, maybe 4 is where you need to be. And next time you try and shoot to be at a 4, and you're like, well, I was actually at a 2, and I played terrible. Well, now what you know, folks, is the thing that you think got you at a 4, actually, or got you at a 6, actually got you at a 4. The thing you think you got you to a 4 actually put you at a 2. And so you recalibrate that, and now you know what you need to do before you go out and play matches, right?
Yeah, I'm sure that we're going to revisit this at some point down the road, and there's a lot more in-depth, obviously, we can go into all these little parts. Like, some of these things we're sort of setting aside. Like, we haven't even talked about visualization. I mean, we could do hours just on that alone. But one of the thing that I want to recommend, especially to the people that have bothered to take some stats or film themselves, like we've suggested earlier, if you happen to listen to those earlier podcasts, is go back and take a quick look at that and add this question in, right? Watch yourself play and ask yourself if watching, you think that what you see matches the same excitement level that you felt on that day, right? Like, do those two things even match up? Because a lot of the times the way that we feel inside is not necessarily what we project externally.
And also, I just want to add a note of caution here, is that the way that you think that you felt during the match now might not be accurate, because it's going to be colored and biased by the outcome of the match and the way you perceive the match in the aftermath. So just on that note, coming back to the excitement diary, I think it is more valuable for you to start consciously paying attention to this moving forward, and setting an excitement level goal for yourself for a match and recording whether or not you met that goal afterwards. That's going to be much more valuable data for you than stuff that might have happened weeks or months ago. And along with that, just keep in mind, like if you don't do it consistently, then it's going to be hard to get what you need out of this. There's that great saying I always love, which is the difference between science and messing around is writing things down. So write it down, people, on your phone, keep a little notebook that you keep in your tennis bag, whatever it is that you do, just find one place and be consistent about it, but just track your levels over, you know, 5 to 10 matches and see. And the other thing that you shouldn't be aware of is, like, the level that you need for singles and level you need for doubles, they're probably not going to be the same thing. I mean, like, for me, my doubles is, it's weird, but I can play great doubles at a very wide range of levels.
But there's a completely different element when you have
another absolutely. It changes involved. The dynamic. It changes your relationship with yourself, even on the court, when you have a second person out there with you. And so my level for doubles, I can play really good doubles anywhere between like a 2 and like a 7, right? And I only really run into trouble if I start to get too high. Whereas singles, I have a much narrower band. It's actually more at the either end of the spectrum that I tend to play better. So just be aware of that. If you're taking notes, don't like treat all of your matches the same. If it's doubles and singles, separate out the doubles and singles from each other and look at them as two kind of separate things. And understand too that if you're not playing with the same partner all the time, the partner can impact your energy levels and even impact where you need to be to play well with a particular partner. So having said all of that, folks, that's kind of a lot. Is we're more shooting for an overview of this today. If there's an area of this that you really want to hear us talk more about, then please do reach out to us. You can email me at glenn@tacticaltennis.com.
And I'm jacob@tacticaltennis.com. And
you can see tweet at either of us.
yeah, you can tweet at either of us, at Tactical Tennis. And Glenn, you are?
At Glenn S. Hill. And, you know, if you haven't followed the Instagram, follow the Instagram. Jake's putting some fun pictures up from practice courts at Wimbledon and qualifying and soon to be the main draw. So you might catch a few cool things there. And as we've asked previously, if you haven't done beforehand, please go to whatever podcast app that you use and rate the podcast, preferably well. It just helps us out to get a little more exposure and get more people listening. And on that note, that's all I've got. Signing off. Have a great day.
Cheers from Wimbledon, folks.